The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, I must draw a nat and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning, Ms. Lawrence.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Astrid Ceballos, and I represent Mr. Meixel. Mr. Meixel asks this court to vacate his conviction under SORNA because his prior Oregon offense is not a categorical match for possession of child pornography and is not a contact offense. So the first issue is whether possession, production, or distribution of child pornography, as set out in 20911-7G, encompasses Mr. Meixel's Oregon offense. Mr. Meixel argued the categorical approach applies to G, and that approach requires the court to match the federal definition of possession of child pornography under SORNA with the Oregon offense under which he was convicted. The Oregon offense of encouraging child abuse in the second degree makes it a crime for a person to, quote, knowingly possess or control or knowingly access with the intent to view a visual recording of sexually explicit conduct involving a child for the purpose of arousing or satisfying the sexual desires of the person or another person.
Counsel, I have a question. We've already decided in a case called Price that subsection I uses the circumstance-specific approach, which I believe the district court also applied to Mr. Meixel. Wouldn't that end the issue here?
The court in Price applied the circumstance-specific approach to section I, and the section that...
Well, I guess my question is, does it make any difference whether we would also use G and H, since I applied to him and the court's already established that?
So in Berry, this court found that generally when a federal statute refers to a generic offense, that text shows Congress's intent that the categorical approach be applied. And recently this court affirmed in Helton that the SMART guidelines can and do have the force and effect of law. The SMART guidelines with respect to Section G say that, or the SMART guidelines say that in general, jurisdictions are not required by SORNA to look beyond the elements of the offense of conviction except with respect to victim age. So even if this court finds that Price applies to I, to this, that the circumstance-specific approach applies to that residual clause, it shouldn't apply to G because the language of G, possession, production, or distribution of child pornography, doesn't show any intent that the circumstance-specific approach be applied. So we should go to the default.
If I applies to Meixel, do we need to... reach G and H necessarily?
So even if this court finds that the circumstance-specific approach in Price applies to the residual clause, Mr. Meixel's offense doesn't qualify under the residual clause. So again, we have to look at the SMART guidelines, and the definition of the SMART guidelines says that the final clause covers any conduct that by its nature is a sex offense against a minor, and that's intended to ensure coverage of convictions under statutes defining sexual offenses in which the status of the victim is a minor is an element to the offense, such as specially defined child molestation or child prostitution offenses, and other offenses prohibiting sexual activity with underage persons. So those definitions accord with the case examples that we have in our brief at page 20. Each of those involve the defendant engaging in a sexual act while interacting directly with a minor. So Schofield, and Meixel's offense doesn't involve any of these.
Right.
It doesn't involve sexual activity with underage persons.
So, counsel, your point is if you apply just I, even using specific circumstance specific, you still have to deal with conduct, correct? And by its nature, sexual offense against a minor. We don't necessarily have that here, do we? Is that your point?
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
That's correct. That this is the Oregon offense that Mr. Meixel was convicted under does not involve the kind of sexual activity and conduct that the SMART guidelines tell us I was intended to cover. And G, which talks about possession and production of child pornography, has to mean something in and of itself. So to interpret I to so broadly as to encompass any state offense that might not fall categorically into the federal generic definition of child pornography would render G superfluous.
So we get to G, if we use G and use a categorical approach, your position is that Oregon statute is broader than the federal statute of child pornography? Is that your position?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. So the Oregon offense, sorry.
No, go ahead.
The Oregon offense, refers to sexually explicit conduct, and that's defined in Oregon Revised Statutes 163.665 to include the lewd exhibition of sexual or other intimate parts. And under Oregon law, other intimate parts includes breasts. But under, so the least serious conduct that the Oregon statute prohibits is possessing an image of the bare breasts of a teenage girl. But that's broader than the federal definition of the under SORNA. That's because even though SORNA doesn't define child pornography, again, it has to have some meaning, and we can perhaps look to Section 2256(8), where Congress defined child pornography for federal purposes. And in that statute, sexually explicit conduct is much narrower than what the Oregon statute allows. So at the federal level,
Counsel, are you saying that Oregon, just because only breasts are shown, it can never be pornography? Are you saying that's the Oregon statute? It said showing the breast alone may not be, but are you saying that if you only show in terms of intimate part, the breast, that depiction can never be child pornography? Is that your representation about Oregon law?
I think that when you're using the categorical approach, you have to look at the least serious conduct that the state offense would prohibit. And in this case, that would be, showing the bare breasts of a teenage girl. And that would not fit under the federal definition of the federal generic definition of child pornography. So while we may think that that should qualify as child pornography, it's not, Congress did not make its intent clear that in SORNA it wanted to apply a different definition than what we have in the federal statute prohibiting possession of child pornography. And in the SMART guidelines, it also refers to sexually explicit visual depictions as being what SORNA is trying to prohibit. And the use of the language sexually explicit there matches the language in 2256. So even if the court finds that we shouldn't import 2256 directly into SORNA, we can still use it as a reference point because of the similarities in the language there to define the federal generic offense of child possession.
What if we applied the circumstance specific to G? Do you think you have any plausible defense in this case?
I think if we apply the circumstance specific approach to G, that this court would still have to figure out what possession of child pornography means.
And, who knows what that means? No one knows what it means. Have you heard anybody be able to define what it means? What child pornography means?
Fortunately, I don't think it's my job to define that. I would argue that
I didn't ask you to define it. I said, who knows? You're just saying you don't know.
Right. I don't know. I would say that it is the best guess we have is that it's the definition laid out in 2256(8) with the corresponding sexually explicit conduct definition. But my point is, I guess, that even if we apply the circumstance-specific approach, we need to know what possession of child pornography means. And so if this court finds that the circumstance-specific approach applies and gives us that definition, then we should remand to the district court to see whether Mr. Meixel's offense, Oregon offense, what the actual conduct was, fits that definition of.
But we know what the conduct was. He was depicting, he was he possessed, by use of a computer, photographs or motion pictures depicting a child engaged in a sexual act. We know what that was. You're telling me that would
We don't actually know.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I know it's difficult because...
We don't know what the...
Go ahead. I won't cut you off.
We don't know what the images actually depicted. So again, just because... since under the Oregon statute, the definition of
we do know, we do know, we do know, counsel, it was a child engaged in sexual conduct. We do know that. And we know that. Are you saying we're deprived of even the definition of sexual engaged in sexual conduct, too?
Well, so if this court finds that the district court's approach to defining possession of child pornography is what the district court said it was, and that the circumstance-specific approach applies, only then would we concede that that addresses this question, that his offense does fit within the within Section
G. Yeah, I think you'd almost have to. Yes. All right, go ahead. That's all the questions I have. Go ahead. What's your argument?
I was just going to say, but if we, in general, when Congress refers to an offense, we don't just substitute any whatever a state calls a particular offense into that slot. So the definite when SORNA refers to possession of child pornography, it must have some independent definition and meaning. So that's why there should be a separate, even if the categorical approach doesn't apply and the circumstance-specific approach does, that should have its own separate meaning, and that's why we would say we should remand to the district court to figure out whether it would fit that federal generic definition instead of just assuming that any state offense that's called child pornography would automatically fit. I'd also like to discuss Mr. Meixel's supervised release conditions. Of course, if the court agrees that his conviction or SORNA must be vacated, the court doesn't need to reach this issue. But the district court erred in imposing the condition requiring him to participate in the computer and internet monitoring program as a special condition of his supervision because it requires a greater deprivation of liberty than is reasonably necessary. So the perpetual monitoring of his internet usage deprives him of more liberty than necessary for a few reasons. One is, as the Supreme Court has found in Packingham, internet usage is integral to First Amendment rights, and access to the internet is critical for...
Counsel?
Yes.
Counsel, the Packingham was a complete prohibition on use of a computer and access to the internet, and as I understand the conditions here, Mr. Maxell would have free access to the internet, and there's a monitoring function because his crime involved the use of the internet. And it's a 5-year supervised release, it's not lifetime. Why is that such a significant deprivation of liberty?
Yeah, it's true that he can still use the internet, but the constant monitoring of his internet use would reveal all of his personal communications contemporaneously, and that would chill his free speech and association rights, and that's why it's more of a deprivation than is necessary. Recently this court found in Shiraz that not having enough of an explanation why lesser restrictions couldn't accomplish
Counsel,
the same.
I have a question. Ms. Collis, what type of restriction would you say is appropriate then? Because it seems to me here the trial court tailored things pretty well in putting the 5-year limitation on, in allowing him the use of the internet. He can't go on anonymously, but other than that, he does have the right to use it. So what kind of restriction would you say be reasonable, assuming that the conviction is upheld?
So the district court actually did impose some other special conditions that we haven't challenged in this appeal that would accomplish the same objectives of protecting the public and that would be tailored to the defendant's particular characteristics and past offense using the computer without unduly infringing his rights. So specifically, conditions L and M authorize the probation officer to subject him to unannounced, random periodic searches without reasonable suspicion of his computer and his internet use. So it would be similar to a random urine screen condition for someone convicted of a drug offense. And together with other conditions requiring him to submit to a sex offender mental health assessment, comply with any sex offender treatment that he's prescribed, and submit to polygraph testing to monitor his compliance with the terms of his release.
Yes. Ms. Corrales, excuse me. So is it your position that any real-time monitoring is a violation of his First Amendment rights?
Yes, that's my position, that if we look at other cases like United States versus Jones and Riley versus California, the court has found that, you know, accessing a person's cell phone, including the internet usage data, and conducting long-term GPS surveillance of a person's public movements, that would infringe on expectations of privacy. And part of the reason for that is that the law enforcement is not resource constrained. So in the past, where those kinds of things might actually require a person, I see that my time has expired. May I take a few moments to finish?
You may.
In the past, when law enforcement would have to do those things in person, it would be very expensive, so they just wouldn't be able to do that. But the real-time continuous monitoring opens up the possibility of law enforcement abuse of collection of that kind of personal information that you can get from a person's internet interactions and daily from a computer or cell phone. Thank you very much.
Mr. Vallis, before you leave the podium, is Ms. Lorish in the room?
She is.
I am, Your Honor.
Well, Ms. Lorish, would you please come to the podium and give an introduction to the student, and as we normally do for the record?
Yes, Your Honor. I've never supervised a student before, as you can tell.
That's okay. That's all right.
Ceballos, she's a third-year student at the University of Virginia School of Law, who's an intern with our office and the Federal Public Defender's Office, and so she's who you heard argument from today. Thank you, and my apologies.
Oh, no problem. I just want to make sure I have two wonderful colleagues with me today, and they're very proud of their being Virginia alums, and I'm glad to clap. Thank you so much for being. Thank you. I know you have time reserved, but I want to make sure. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Lawrence.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Ms. Hudson, you may come up.
Good morning. The court has noted this court's decision in Price really puts to rest the greatest extent of the appellant's argument regarding the circumstance-specific approach for subsection I. And the government would argue that the language in Price goes further than that, although we acknowledge that the holding in Price was limited to subsection I. The court's discussion of the reasoning for why the circumstance-specific approach applies to I supports the government's position that the circumstance-specific approach also applies to subsections G and H. In particular, the Price court was focused on the distinction between subsections 5A, little Roman numeral 1, and 5A, little Roman numeral 2, where subsection 2 does not contain the word elements, and subsection 1 does. They found that very significant. And in addition, subsection 7 overall makes no reference to the term elements. The Price court cited to the 11th Circuit's Dodge decision, which also added to that list of reasons, the fact that the title of subsection 7 was an expanded definition of a specified offense against a minor, stating that it was intended to include all meant to include all offenses by child predators. So that expanded definition was another reason that the court found the circumstance-specific approach would apply to all of subsection 7, which would be G, H, and I. And then finally, and most importantly, in the Dodge decision, which the Price court cited, the Dodge court made clear that the language in subsection I was the fourth in the litany of reasons supporting their decision that the circumstance-specific approach applied to subsection G. Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Hudson, yes. I'll take you back to I. Your position is that the circumstance-specific analysis would be sufficient for I, correct? That you're saying?
Yes, sir, as well as for G and H.
So if we're using that, what is the conduct? What is the conduct that's against the minor? Because all you have to connect it, it says any conduct that by its nature is a sexual offense against a minor. What is the conduct?
So, Mr. Mixel, and I think the district court made this clear in its decision below, the conduct was really twofold. First, he possessed the image, which was in fact child pornography. And secondly, the conduct, his offense conduct involved the sex abuse of a child, which again, not just child pornography in particular, but the Oregon statute makes clear that in order to be convicted under that statute, it requires sex abuse of a child in the image.
So what if it was anime? Anime can be child pornography. I can tell you in the Fourth Circuit there are cases that say cartoons can constitute child pornography. So what would be then the conduct? Because we don't know whether these images were a cartoon or not, do we?
Well, what I can say is that...
No, first, answer the question. On this record, do we know whether this motion picture child pornography was cartoon?
The only way I can answer that is to say that Mr. Mixel's plea stated that he agreed that the image that he possessed reflected
a child. It does. Cartoons can do that. They do it all. Unfortunately, they do it quite a bit in the dark web.
Well, a cartoon could, but I would suppose that we wouldn't say that it was a child if it were a cartoon we were speaking of.
In the Fourth Circuit, we say that cartoons can constitute child pornography.
And I would just argue, based on this record, that although a cartoon may depict a child, when we say it was a child, it's not a cartoon.
What it said was he possessed by computer a photograph or motion picture depicting child engaged in sexual act. So you mean depicting means it has to be a real person? That's what you mean?
What I wanted to refer the court
to. That's what he pled guilty to under this record. That's all we have. And there's another reference to it that was a motion picture. And then another it says photograph. But it doesn't say, so how is that resolved even in the circumstance specific? For example, you know now we have artificial intelligence. They can show a motion picture and it never happened. And it doesn't look like a cartoon at all. It looks like people really doing it, but it's all in the science of motion picture technology. It never was a person at all in front of a camera. A child wasn't near it. It was in a studio. Came from a lab, photographic lab. So you're saying that is conduct. It said it has to be against a minor. No minors involved at all. They're all adults using technology.
My position is that on this record, looking at JA-33, the defendant specifically agreed that the photograph he possessed did depict a child engaged in a sexual act. And given that the Oregon statute requires child abuse in order to be guilty, I don't think he could possibly be guilty of the Oregon statute where an image was in fact a cartoon and in our view would not constitute child abuse, even if it were a cartoon. It would not be child abuse. The Oregon statute says that a person who knowingly possesses or controls a visual recording of sexually explicit conduct involving a child and knows that the creation of the visual recording of sexually explicit conduct involved child abuse. So I don't think you can have child abuse involving a cartoon.
We're interpreting the Oregon statute in that regard for a specific circuit, right?
In this case, that's my position, that the offense to which he pled guilty, given that he said it was a photograph depicting a child involved in a sexual act, and where the Oregon statute requires that he knows or is aware of or consciously disregards the fact that the creation of the recording of sexually explicit conduct involved child abuse, that it would eliminate cartoons.
So now it sounds like you're doing a categorical analysis. We're supposed to interpret the federal statute, aren't we? They used it for the specific conduct, isn't it? Do we go back to now? You're saying we should go back and analyze Oregon statute for that purpose.
Well, what I'm saying is to connect the dots that the court was asking about regarding whether or not anime could be included in this. I think you have to look at the Oregon statute and decide that it could not, in this case, have been a cartoon. But if the court is asking whether our position is that the circumstance-specific approach applies nonetheless to subsection G.
But G is easier, isn't it?
It doesn't
matter whether it's anime or not. Is that correct? It's still to be child pornography, if it is child pornography.
Simply says possession of child pornography.
Right. Okay.
And so our view, again, is the circumstance-specific approach applies to G, H, and I. And for the reasons we've discussed, we believe that this is conduct sufficient to establish that it was possession of child pornography under G. It was certainly conduct that by its nature is a sex offense against a minor and as well qualifies under H as criminal sexual conduct involving a minor. I'm sorry. Regarding the computer monitoring provisions that the court imposed in this case, the government's position, I think, is sufficiently presented in the brief. But our view, of course, is that the district court in this case did tailor this condition to the circumstances of this case. As Judge Agee has pointed out, it was only a 5-year term of supervision. The defendant does have access to the internet. He can speak, he can express himself, he can disclose his opinions to whomever he pleases. He's simply subject to the monitoring in this case for the reasons that the court set out in its opinion and in the at the hearing. Relating to the nature of this particular defendant's conduct. I think it was important in this case regarding the court's decision that Mr. Meixel not only had possessed the computer image but had also absconded from supervision not only in Oregon but in the Western District of Virginia in this case by removing his location monitoring device and had as well been previously convicted of failing to register as a sex offender as required. So for all of those reasons, in order to protect the public and to address the other goals of supervision, the condition in this case was appropriate, and we ask the court to affirm Judge Moon's decision in that regard.
Ms. Hudson, you would agree that just outside of the context of probation, that monitoring your every activity with the computer is a extreme First Amendment surveillance, isn't it? Outside of the context, I'm talking about just an ordinary citizen. Would you agree that would be an extreme surveillance of your First Amendment rights?
Certainly, I agree that that computer monitoring of a citizen would. At least begin to be an infringement, yes.
It would be extreme, wouldn't it, in our society, wouldn't it? Look at the things
on
your...
You're
accessing your bank account, your friends, your political views, your thoughts, your love, your hate, your crying, your every emotion. I mean, people use the internet. Wouldn't you agree that would be an extreme First Amendment surveillance or chilling effect?
If there were absolutely no other connection to any reasoning, yes.
All right. So but you think that extreme First Amendment surveillance is not violated here because?
Correct.
Because he loses all of those rights?
It's certainly the case that a person on supervision does not ipso facto have no Fourth Amendment rights. I think that's clear from
First
from
Amendment. First Amendment rights.
Correct. But it's also true that a probationer and, in this case, more significantly, a person on supervised release who has served a term of incarceration and has been released has given up substantial amounts of privacy in that regard. And our position is simply that in this case, the condition that the court imposed does not infringe on his First Amendment rights. He can say whatever he wants to say. He can access the internet. He can communicate with people. He's simply being monitored for the purpose of determining whether or not he's continuing to engage in sexually criminal conduct. And in that regard, it's not an extreme imposition or infringement on his First Amendment rights. And again, we think the district court got this right and should be affirmed.
But that's the problem. You say it's just he has access. But don't in other regimes around the world, isn't that the most powerful part of the suppression, that everything you say is going to be monitored by the government? That's an incredible, isn't it?
Well, the way the court expressed it is not exactly how I would express it. Certainly, the monitoring is taking place consistently, but the probation officer is only interested in looking at anything from that monitoring system that might be that might fall within the court's condition prohibiting certain activity. So, picking up Ms. Lorsch's example from brief, where she compared this to a camera around the neck of a defendant recording his activities 24/7, it's really not that at all, where the monitoring is being done for these limited purposes described by the court and at the sentencing hearing and in the documents that are associated with his condition as well.
Yeah, but that you're putting on that spin for this purpose. If it was that purpose, you would say, well, if you get on websites that involve children, involves pornography, the dark web, it's not specific at all. If you get on there to talk about your health situation, let's suppose you believe you have some symptoms of health and you go on to monitor the Mayo Clinic or NIH, those things, I mean, those are very personal things. And they have implications in terms of a lot of things. The fact that government can look at all of that, is that necessary? I mean, can it be tailored? Don't you think they would be tailored in terms of what we're looking at? We want to make sure this person doesn't get a, you can't go to a school site. You can't Google a high school, an elementary school. You can't. So it doesn't have to be dark websites. It could be all things, children, museums, whatever. But to tether to something that's anchored to the crime and the fear, but everything you get on the internet for is monitored, and there's no limitation. Well, we're only looking for this, but we'll look at everything. Is there something wrong about that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with what the court did in this case. And again, the looking at the remote com user agreement, where it specifies that Mr. Mikesell is not to search for, view, or download, and so forth, materials that include but are not limited to images of his victim and images related to his crime or similar crimes or images that depict individuals similar to his victims, e.g. children. And that tied with the court's remarks that the court was concerned about not only the fact that he had had a computer, but his essentially flaunting the law regarding the other regulatory requirements he was subject to. Clearly, in the government's view, the court has limited that intrusion to some significant degree. And I think further, if I'm not mistaken, I think the conditions of probation that were not just in the remote com agreement, but the explicit conditions of probation, I think make even more clear that the probation officer is searching for evidence related to this offense. So we think the conditions are tailored sufficiently to address the constitutional concerns that Mr. Mikesell raises. And if there are no further questions, the government would rely otherwise on its briefs.
Thank you, counsel.
Hello again, Your Honors. I have just a few points I'd like to make on rebuttal. So first, the government still hasn't explained why random, unannounced, suspicionless searches of computer and internet usage by the defendant is not enough to protect the public and accomplish the other purposes of supervised release. If we look at the remote comm user agreement in Section 21, it says the defendant has to voluntarily waive any expectation of privacy from probation, parole, agencies, and other governments responsible for supervision, and this third-party company, RemoteCom itself. And they have to inform others that their device is being monitored and that any communications with lawyers, doctors, and clergy members, which would normally be private and confidential, would be that they waive any expectation of privacy in that information. And there's
it seems like a potential chilling effect to someone trying to get help, for example.
I agree.
They
yes.
wanted to talk
yes.
to somebody about, let me work through these things. Instead, that could be used, aha, you see, he talked to a therapist. This is hypothetical, of course. He talked to a therapist, and he's not making progress. You know, because we're in an area, well, and it's not this case, but people spend long sentences, and when it's time to get out, then they make motions sometime that they can't get out because they're in danger forever. This is not the case, but this is a very touchy area in terms of who's looking at what you do, and they're listening to what you say to a counselor, those kind of things. Go ahead.
Precisely, and I think particularly in this circumstance where the defendant, one of the other conditions is that he undergo sex offender mental health assessments, the government already is going to have access to any private information about the difficulties that he's going through with trying to rehabilitate, and any further infringement on his rights to communicate with a doctor or a lawyer or a clergy. It just isn't justified. And again, we have no explanation from the government why random, unannounced, suspicionless searches by probation of his computer are not enough in this case. And then the second point I wanted to make was about Section G. So the cartoon, the anime hypothetical, shows why even if the circumstance-specific approach applies to G, the court should clarify the federal definition of possession of child pornography under SORNA and then remand to the district court to figure out whether the material here, we don't actually know if it was anime. It could have been anime. The definition of visual depiction under the Oregon statutes that includes a computer-generated image or picture produced by electronic, mechanical, or other means, which could certainly right. encompass cartoons. And even that shows, I would go further and say that shows the difficulty of applying the circumstance-specific approach to G, because especially several years after the initial offense has occurred, we don't always know all of the details of what exactly was included in the images. So it would make more sense going forward for defendants to know the categorical approach applies to G and this state's offense fits within the federal definition of child pornography or doesn't. So for fair notice purposes, it would be beneficial if the circumstance-specific approach did not apply to G. It would just make more sense. That also helps show why H and I shouldn't be expanded to as sort of a catch-all for anything that might not fit in the federal generic offense of child pornography. The SMART guidelines also tell us that SORNA isn't meant to cover every single sex offense, but only the sex offenses that have been defined under SORNA. So specifically it says the term sex offense is not used to refer to any and all crimes of a sexual nature, but rather to those covered by the definition of sex offense appearing in SORNA. So especially when we don't know what the content of the images was at this much later date, we shouldn't assume that we can just catch the offense under H and I, even if it doesn't fit categorically within Section G. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Savalas, before you leave the podium, I just want to say that thank you so much. The Cavaliers were well heard today, and you acquitted it very well. And Ms. Lawrence, thank you so much for your involvement and your leadership with students. We appreciate that so much. Thank you. And of course, Ms. Hudson.
Thank you.
And Ms. Hudson, thank you for your very able representation of the United States here today. I regret that because of the circumstances of technology today, we won't be able to come down and greet you, but know that all of us and each of us appreciate your argument, and although we can't physically extend our hand, we do so with our hearts today and appreciate your argument. Well done. I'm going to ask Mr. Coleman to
We'll stand up here so you can see us.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you to all three of you. And Mr. Coleman, if you would adjourn the court for the day, I'd appreciate it.
This honorable court stands adjourned, signed by God. God save the United States and this honorable court.